This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The state is paying two administrators big salaries to run just one state university system. We're also starting to wonder about the best way to rebuild the I-84 viaduct through Hartford. There's one idea, just shut the whole thing down and get it rebuilt. Gulp. We also might see God coming back into politics this week on the liberal side of the political spectrum. Those are a few of the stories we'll tackle today in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. It's also just a week out from the big primaries, and we're going to be talking about that and some of the statewide races, some of the city races that we've been following throughout the course of the last few months. That's coming up a bit later in the show. I want to welcome in our guest. As always, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello once again, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Joining us for the first time is Max Reese. He's a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. I think last time you were going to come in, Max, everyone got typhoid or something like that. So we're glad to actually have you back this time.
It is wonderful to be here, and I hope no one gets sick.
We're setting the bar low. We'll see how it goes. And our friend Kalila Brown-Dean is back. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Hello, Dr. Brown-Dean.
Good to see you, John.
So first of all, we're going to start with some presidential politics. There's a new candidate in the race after exceeding his $1 million crowdfunding goal. Harvard Law School professor Lawrence Lessig announced that he's running for president. He says that he's going to get people acknowledging the elephant in the room, recognizing that we've got a government that doesn't work. The stalemate partisan platform of American politics in Washington right now does not work, he told George Stephanopoulos. He's going to be a referendum president. Colin, does Larry Lessig getting into this race mean anything to a lot of Americans? Does it mean anything to you?
Well, he's right, obviously. I mean, he's so right that I think one of the things we're not going to be able to talk about today just because of time is the merger of these two gigantic television corporations that own two of the stations Max doesn't work for.
But they're wonderful people
right
over there.
One of the theories about why that's happening and when it's happening is that they're going to chase campaign money, that there's so much money in politics right now, it's actually worth it to big corporations to strategize around that. I mean, strategize at a pretty high level around that. Now, one thing I'll say about Lessig is that, you know, he sometimes strikes me as a tiny bit out of date. For example, he is under the impression that, at least he was a few months ago, that Connecticut has significantly reformed its election financing system and that we should be a shining city on a hill, a beacon to the nation, whereas if you're kind of at the ground level and you watched what happened in the Foley Malloy campaign, the amount of private money that came in from third-party sources and the way that CEP money, the citizens' election money, gets thrown around for all kinds of evil purposes, it doesn't look so great. So one thing I'd ask him to do is kind of get up to speed. I mean, here we tried to do a lot of the right things, and it hasn't worked.
It hasn't worked, and that's the sort of thing you'd get if you read an article in the New York Times from, say, 2009 about Connecticut. But if you haven't got more up to date, you wouldn't have seen some of the stuff. Do you think, Kalila, that there's anything to Larry Lessig getting in and saying some of the things that a lot of us say all the time about big money in politics, but maybe with a fresh voice?
So I think it's important, particularly when we talk about dark money, where we don't know the sources, we don't know to whom these funders are connected. But what I think is also important beyond the funding is his question of what is the democracy that we have? What's the democracy that we want, and what do we need to do to get there? And that's something that really no other candidate is talking about, the fact that there is no affirmative right to vote in the United States, but we use that language. So what would that mean? But I also think it cautions us to think about the consequence of that. You know, his colleague, Sid Verba, has this piece that asks, would the dream of political equality turn out to be a nightmare? So that if you have more voices participating, people who traditionally get overlooked in campaigns, does that mean that you and I have to compete more to get our views across, and how will Americans respond? We kind of know how people respond when their interests are threatened, but I think this is bigger than just money.
Is it a big deal, Max, him getting into the race?
I think it's the wrong Harvard professor getting into the race that people thought was going to get into the race. He's running on a campaign finance reform platform, which gets people really excited out there in the polls. It's kind of like a governor running on prison reform. You know, it's not something that's really going to rile people up. I think that he's going to raise questions that other candidates are going to have to talk about campaign finance. The point about dark money is tremendous because we just got through a governor's race, which was all dark money here in the state of Connecticut. We still don't know where so much of the money for both Governor Malloy's campaign and for Tom Foley's campaign came from. But the fact is, he's an unknown name to probably, if I was to bet, 95% of the electorate. So realistically, what's his impact going to be? I think it'll probably be minimal on the grand scale, but it'll force questions to be answered.
Will it actually force Hillary Clinton to do anything, Colin? I mean, at the end of the day, does she answer questions because Larry Lessig is now talking about the influence, the pernicious influence of big money?
Well, I mean, it's probably a mistake to see all candidates, because we're going to talk about Bernie Sanders in just a second, as people who exert this kind of gravitational pull on Hillary Clinton. This person does that, this person does that, this person does that. I mean, Lessig's critique, yeah, is a much bigger critique than what would be just solely directed at Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, you know, you start thinking about other people in the race who raised a lot of money. I mean, at least as far as the Democratic side of it, I mean, it really is about her. So that was no answer whatsoever.
Well, look, let's actually turn to Bernie Sanders. And I want to, first of all, not correct, but maybe clarify something that I said last week. We got an email or a tweet, I think it was, from a listener who said something that Colin and I hear quite a bit, which is that there's a media conspiracy to not talk about the Bernie Sanders campaign. And the point I was trying to make last week is that there may well not be enough attention being paid to his campaign, but I can assure you that the media can't really conspire to do much of anything, let alone freeze out a candidate like Bernie Sanders. We actually read something interesting from our colleagues up at Vermont Public Radio who had to put this on their website. We've heard from many listeners recently regarding NPR's coverage of Bernie Sanders. In particular, many felt that Mara Liasson's analysis last Wednesday during All Things Considered regarding a possible Joe Biden bid for president missed the mark. They shared the concerns directly with the colleagues at NPR, who basically said that Mara Liasson's comment about Clinton basically running against herself was intended to mean that her campaign is being buffeted in large part by issues related to things she's done, including using a private email server, rather than by attacks from other campaigns. Essentially, Kalila, there does seem to be, including for many folks in Vermont, for many folks in Connecticut here, a notion that the media doesn't want to talk about the fact that Bernie Sanders is kind of right now kicking Hillary Clinton's butt in a couple states where they're polling, and they don't want to talk at all about the things that he's actually saying out on the campaign trail. As someone who observes this stuff professionally, I mean, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's not necessarily a Bernie Sanders phenomenon. I think that American politics, the coverage of politics, always focuses on the names that are well known or the personalities that are big or controversial. That's not Bernie Sanders. So he definitely has an appeal. He's appealing to a particular demographic. He's getting people to come to these rallies that normally would not come. And he's being successful that way. So I think you may not have traditional media covering this at the same level as, say, you know, what's Donald Trump's latest outburst. But people are talking and connecting. And the question for me is, to Bernie Sanders, do you want that kind of coverage? You know, does Bernie Sanders feel that he's being slighted, or is he saying my message can reach the people that I want to connect with in a different form? That's more important than how many media hits I get.
Max?
I think I've kind of equated the Bernie Sanders presidential run to the Ron Paul presidential run on the right. In Iowa, Ron Paul supporters got to control the Iowa Republican Party at one point in the last 4 years. I think the question on the GOP side has always been, is the GOP primary going to keep pulling someone farther to the right? On the Democratic side, I think with Bernie Sanders in the race, will that pull Hillary Clinton farther and further to the left? And it's obvious that in New Hampshire, she obviously is not getting the support she thought she was going to get, considering her success there in 2008. Now you have Bernie Sanders, who's from the state next door. He's very popular up there. And I think it's a question of, well, first of all, we haven't really covered him very fairly in my business. And what I will say is, because it's more – every story starts with, oh, yeah, that guy with the bad hair, the Jewish guy from Vermont, he's running for president. Oh, yeah, it's not Hillary Clinton. Instead of, he's a serious contender, the way the 2008 race was, when there were multiple serious contenders.
And you know, Max just did it. I just did it before. We mentioned the gravitational pull of Hillary Clinton whenever we talk about Bernie Sanders, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think Max's Ron Paul analogy is apt and can be extended a little bit more, too. Both of these candidates were kind of anti-politician politicians. See, Trump, George Packer wrote a great piece about this, comparing Trump and Bernie in The New Yorker last week. You know, Trump is an anti-politician guy. He's really not a politician. I mean, he's just running. In fact, he's running to hate politicians. That's like his biggest point, is politicians are scum. You know, Sanders and Paul, they really couldn't make that argument because they are politicians. They are pretty much career politicians. So that's number one. Number two is they're similar, too, that since their followers have this kind of fervor. And the fervor often translates as people who aren't getting our message are either stupid or evil or both. And it's not sort of a Dale Carnegie thing. It's not a good way to, you know, make friends and influence people. So one of the things they need to do probably is turn down that rhetoric a little bit more. Yeah, in terms of conspiracies, this is really true. Yesterday, it was Tucker's birthday, and we had to put in a big barbecue order so we could all have takeout lunch together here in the newsroom. And John was really excited that it came out right, that like all the barbecue. So that's the kind of conspiracy that we could maybe pull off. Wait, like John was.
Are you saying that Bernie Sanders is bringing barbecue to the
Bernie
primary?
Sanders will give us barbecue. First of all, I will mention him a lot more than I do. But no, John was like really thrilled that we were able to pull off this complicated barbecue order. So that's the level of plotting that we're able to engage in. In terms of actually sort of, you know, manipulating elections and stuff like that, I think that's a little beyond our ken.
I will just say, Khalil, I have been struck by periodically, and I work very closely with the folks at NPR, and I love them dearly, but I do periodically hear every conversation turn to, is Biden getting into the race? Is Hillary going to be able to withstand? And at the end of the day, you know, Larry Lessig getting into the race is another person who's bringing a new set of ideas, perhaps a new set of followers here. We have, frankly, only really been covering one candidate on the Republican side, to be fair, but perhaps there is some room here over the course of this next full year to talk a little bit more about what various varieties of Democrats may bring to the fold.
And a lot can change in a year. You know, think about Wes Clark was up in the polls for a full month. No one knew who Wes Clark was until he made this Get Out the Vote commercial with young people. And he talked about whether OutKast was going to break up as a musical group. And young people said, wait a minute, here's the one guy who listens to the kind of music that I do. He went up in the polls. A week later, he was out of the picture. So I think it's too early to put a lot into these polls and to think about who's going to block others out. But look at what's happening at the grassroots level, where you have people like Mike Huckabee going to Kentucky, appealing to a particular base of people. You see these massive rallies with Bernie Sanders and then counter rallies as well in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement. That's the kind of everyday form of Democratic participation that we should be focusing on now instead of trying to project out a year from now.
So the message is that Bernie needs to get Big Boy at more of his rallies.
Exactly. Right. Well, I kind of prefer Andre 3000. Okay. But
this thing, I'm actually writing down a list. Colin says, be nicer to them. We need to bring barbecue and we need to get OutKast back together. Bernie can actually draw some media attention.
Well, what I'm wondering is, does that mean Bernie's going to start wearing better ties on the campaign trail? That's what I wonder.
Probably.
I don't know. But I think we love talking about the possibility of a floor fight. We love talking about the possibility of this unbelievable behind-the-scenes backroom deal to give someone a nomination. Okay, well, if you support this liberal policy, then we'll give you my delegates. Because people really thought, to get back to the Ron Paul conversation we had, people really thought that Ron Paul was going to be able to barter his delegates to Mitt Romney for 3 years ago. They really thought that. It didn't happen. Nothing even remotely similar to that happened. Hillary Clinton in 2008 had a lot of delegates. It didn't matter. I mean, you know, she in the middle of the day of the camp at the Democrat convention, she just gave her delegates to Obama. I think with Bernie Sanders, if Bernie Sanders stays in the race, and forget about Biden for now, I'm not going to talk about it until he gets in the race. But if it let's say that keeps going, and then they both split a bunch of primary states or caucuses, that could be really interesting for this conversation a year from now.
So just to Kalila's point and Max's point are really similar, which is it's the summertime. People are interested in. I mean, there's been two
sound bites.
There's been two political stories: Trump and Hillary's emails. Those are basically the two political stories. Now, some of this stuff starts to fall into place. Some of these dominoes start tipping. People may get, the press, including, may get really interested in Bernie Sanders. But I'm not even sure. And I know I agree with everybody else. We haven't covered him enough, but we haven't not covered him that. You know, that badly.
People know who he is.
We haven't not covered him that badly, and I stand by that. I mean, as things kind of get rolling, I think his significance will be either become apparent or will disappear.
Well, let's talk about one of the big issues that is happening in America right now. And the headline of my next little thing to go to is Blumenthal surprises nobody, supports Iran nuclear agreement. Obviously, you talked with Richard Blumenthal and wrote about this in your current column, Colin. No big surprise that Blumenthal did what he did, but he sort of came out at the last possible second once all of the support had already been garnered.
I think it's a tiny bit of a surprise. I mean, I heard from a lot of people after he was on my show saying, wow, he sounds like he's not going to vote for
it. I never got that for a
minute.
I never
got that. I mean,
I never got that either.
Yeah, I wrote back to Steve Metcalf, our music writer here, who said that. And I said, you know what? You've got great ears for orchestra. I got Blumenthal ears, and I can hear what he's saying. He was really kind of laying the groundwork in very subtle ways. And so, yeah, I mean, the question is really, should you have done this maybe a little bit sooner? You've got a safe seat, but we've been over that.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see what the backlash is and what the fallout is from this. Does this mean that a new challenger will emerge, even though I think Blumenthal, as you said, is pretty secure in that position? But also, what's at stake, not just for him personally, but what can this deal mean? And the thing I tell my students all the time, there's no such thing as perfection in government or political choices. Everything has a trade-off and a consequence. And this Iran deal, with Blumenthal now coming forth to say it at this point, makes that clear.
He kept saying the words conscience and conviction. What did he say on your show, Colin? 75 times he said the combination of conscience and conviction?
I know. He took a drink every time. I was really drunk by the end.
That's unbelievable. You sounded great, though. I think that when Chuck Schumer came out against the Iran deal, that surprised just about everyone. And you kind of thought, all right, well, Blumenthal and Schumer are attached at the hip. And you thought, okay, well maybe he's going to go against it. But then I agree with Colin. Over the last 2 weeks, when he became the only person in the state of Connecticut in the congressional delegation not supporting it, I think there was some writing on the wall there. And there was really never a doubt that he was going to come out for it. And then he was able to do the copy and paste press release from Larson and Esty and Murphy saying this isn't perfect, but it's a deal we have, and so we're going to take this deal.
You know, Kalila said, what's the fallout? The other fallout, and it'll be fallout we don't see, which I think is actually typical of fallout, but is that people in Washington, people, your fellow members of Congress, they don't like it when you drag something out in a way that you don't have to. And as a result, I mean, I mentioned this last week, people like Joe Donnelly and Claire McCaskill, people who are in much more problematic states, who declared much earlier, you know, you need favors from people. You need help from people to get your stuff passed. So it would have been a smarter thing for him to declare whatever he thinks he reaped by dragging the shot clock down to zero. He lost a lot of clout and cooperation and collegiality at the Washington level. It was probably a mistake on that basis.
And John and Kalila both alluded to it. You know, what is the consequence, the political consequence? If Larry Kudlow gets into this race to go against Richard Blumenthal, attack him from the right, campaigning on a platform of I would have been against the Iran deal, I don't know if that's something that would rile up people in New Haven, Bridgeport, and Stamford.
But I know that it will make us really, really happy in the media, because that will be a lot of fun to cover.
My fingers are crossed. That's all I say.
Max Reese is political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Kalila Brown Dean is associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Our own Colin McEnroe is here as well. We are talking about people who are attached to the hip. Later, we'll be talking about Mike Huckabee and Kim Davis. Theirs attached by the hip. We're also going to be talking about the primaries coming up 1 week from today. And also, what do we do to rebuild the I-84 viaduct? One idea is just close the whole thing down for a while. This is The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're here with Kalila Brown Dean from Quinnipiac University, Max Reese, who's the political reporter for NBC Connecticut, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, did you know you could mix two wines together and get something even better? Wait a minute, that's the food schmooze. I don't host the food schmooze, do I? No, we're talking to Maddie Dix. Maddie Dix is a teacher, an author, and most importantly, a storyteller, and a guy who really believes that everybody can benefit from storytelling, that you can actually sort of, I don't know, almost kind of order your life a little bit by making it more memorable by telling stories. So we're going to talk about that.
Very good. Storytelling this afternoon with Colin McEnroe at 1 o'clock. There's a lot going on in just a week here before the primaries for mayoral races across Connecticut. The big ones we've been focusing on, Hartford, of course. Luke Bronin is going to be in the program tomorrow. We had Pedro Segarra on just a few weeks ago. Luke Bronin will be part of our program tomorrow. Kalila Brandino, you've also been following the Bridgeport race for mayor. Colin has interviewed all three of the Democrats who are running for that nomination. And you've noticed a lack of diversity on the ticket.
You know, I always feel like Bridgeport is the gift that keeps on giving when it comes to political stories. And so now in Bridgeport, you have two white male candidates, one an incumbent, one a former mayor, running and trying to see or accuse each other of who's the most racist, right? Which is disturbing on a number of levels. You know, if you put out a flyer that has a picture of a Klansman and then you say, well, no, this person prevented someone from being honored about the Voting Rights Act of 65, the key question is, what are the issues facing the people of Bridgeport? What are the key concerns? What are the primary interests? And none of that is being addressed because it's all about this name calling. And I think it's also troubling when you think about issues of race that are going on across the country. When you're talking about life or death issues based on one's identity, this mudslinging does nothing to heal that city or to really move it forward.
So one of the things that we've been talking about, though, in the Hartford race is there's a race component of the Hartford race as well. There's a white candidate who comes from Greenwich originally. He's been accused by the incumbent mayor of not spending enough time in Hartford to actually be able to be mayor, but also essentially being accused of not being one of us. And there's some undertones there because Hartford is a majority-minority community. A lot of Puerto Ricans, a lot of Latinos from other descent, and a lot of African Americans and Caribbean Americans. So here you've got a case where you've actually got a Puerto Rican mayor running against a white outsider candidate. So race is part of it. We're actually talking about some of these issues, and I don't know if we're talking about it in a constructive way here either, Kalila.
Well, it's a very nuanced issue. When the demographic of a community changes, some people are fearful of that change and others embrace that as progress. But it always is the question of, you know, just because you look like me doesn't mean that you represent my interests. And so this has to be an issue-based concern for the people of Hartford, for Bridgeport, if it's Newark that we're talking about, cities across the country. And when you use that us versus them language that, you know, we were talking before the show about Alabama in the 1960s, it's very much the same rhetoric. It's now different in terms of who's using it, but the outcome is the same. Do we want people to lead our community who look like us, who have a vested interest in our community, or does that become enough of a credential?
I'm going to sound horribly cynical and just say so much of this is just about, from the candidate end anyway, is about path to victory, right? I mean, does anybody in the Bridgeport race seriously think anybody else in the Bridgeport race is a racist? No. It's just potentially profitable at the polls to go after them on, like, you leave something like that open. In fact, that whole thing about honoring the civil rights hero was also about sort of jockeying around. It was about Finch trying to shut Ganim down in certain ways.
It's so all this, pandering.
Yeah, it's all pandering. It's all, you know, and the same thing's happening in Hartford, really. I mean, I have no way of proving this, but I firmly believe that if Pedro Segarra were not in this race, if he were just watching it from his home in the West End, and he was watching, you know, somebody like Luke Bronin run against somebody like Joel Cruz, he wouldn't really be concerned about the identity politics piece of this, and he might be voting for the Luke Bronin guy. This isn't really a fire in the belly kind of issue for him, but it's his path to victory. And so, I mean, so the other part of it that you have to be concerned about is how do these messages get heard? They're being sent out for fairly cynical reasons, but they may be heard at a much more emotive and genuine level. I mean, in other words, Puerto Ricans in Hartford may really feel like their city is being taken away from them.
But I think there's something to the fact that when you either talk about, you know, somebody's racist or somebody else isn't racist, and you end up with conversations about whether or not someone is qualified to come from the outside and run the city of Hartford. I don't know, Max, there's a lot of people at the state capitol and around the state as well who see a lot of their tax dollars going to cities like Bridgeport and in Hartford and saying, look, we really don't want to support this type of political environment, especially when we have cities that are in some ways so in need of fixing.
The state system is designed, the state system is designed to prop up all the cities. And I think the question is, who will be the steward of those funds? And you look at what's going on in Hartford right now, and to use the cynicism point from Colin, at the beginning of the Hartford mayor's race, it was not as overt. It was more like Pedro Segarra saying, look at how great I am. Look at what I've done for you. Here's what I can continue to do for you. And then slowly but surely, as Luke Bronin became not just a serious contender, but the front runner candidate, by virtue of the Democratic Town Committee nomination. Not that that many people pay attention to that, but nevertheless. And then it turned into this more overt subtlety, if you will. Pedro Segarra putting out a web video in both Spanish and English saying to people, I am one of you. Staring at the camera, I am one of you. Saying about Luke Bronin, you're not one of us. Never mind the fact that Luke Bronin has these qualifications that you would never expect for someone like that to be running for Hartford mayor, which brings me to the next point. How often have you seen television ads for a Hartford mayor's race? A lot of this stuff is brand new territory that many people haven't seen before.
And to be fair, you see this on both sides. So Bronin has the ad where he's talking to African-American residents of Hartford about crime, about their concerns of making things better. So this is really a universal piece. But I think the question for voters is, what is going to be the return for your vote? So if you continue to allow candidates to come to your houses of worship, to come to your community centers, and you only see them once every 2 years, then you can't be surprised that your schools continue to fail because a mayor, a candidate, takes for granted that your support will be there. So leverage that vote, leverage that support, and then I think voters can be satisfied.
Although you don't want that to turn into the very kind of specific horse trading where, in fact, the person who gets elected has all these obligations that were basically, once again, right, the result of this kind of bargaining.
In a city like Hartford, that could be very easily happen.
Right. And that usually takes the form of city hall jobs and contracts and stuff like that. So you have to be a little bit careful with that process. But to me, there's kind of an unanswerable question here in Hartford. And, I mean, we know that Segarra is not a very good manager. I mean, we do know that. That's a known known, as Rumsfeld would say. The known unknown is, what does Luke Bronin really bring to all this? I mean, you know, he's a technocrat. He's a guy who seems to understand how government works. He's worked in government in some pretty interesting capacities. He's never worked in an urban municipal capacity. And it really is an open question. You know, you have a pretty dysfunctional city government here. So what could he do in 4 years? And anybody who says they know the answer to that question is, in my opinion, mistaken.
And I think another point, which is to piggyback on Colin again, is when you're trying to present this image of who Luke Bronin is to more than just the Hartford metro area, these are TV ads that are going across the state of Connecticut. It's getting ready for something else. We don't know what the something else is, but he wants someone in New Haven, someone in Stonington, someone in Danbury to be able to look at him at some point or another on TV and go, oh, yeah, that's a Luke Bronin guy. I've seen him before.
Are you saying that he has political aspirations beyond Hartford?
I did not say that, John.
I'm actually shocked.
Do not
shocked.
Put words in my mouth. That's not what I came on this show
look,
for.
I have to say we're going to do a little PSA here. If you are an unaffiliated voter and you want to vote in your local primary, you have until next Tuesday at noon to register with the party. If you're already registered in a political party, there's a 3-month waiting period before voting in a primary. You can register to vote online at ct.gov. Very quickly, Kalila, we saw this. Oregon's Governor Kate Brown signed a first-in-the-nation bill to automatically register all eligible Oregonians to vote when they obtain or renew a driver's license. Essentially, you have to opt out if you don't want to be on the voting rolls. Is this what states should do?
I think it's an excellent move. I think that if we want our democracy to be inclusive, we want to reduce the barriers to voter participation, this is an excellent first step. Now the task is to get people to the polls.
Is this not the most pro-voter ID law you've ever seen? You have to have a driver's license. They make a differentiation between legal resident and just a driver as well. It's an impressive piece of legislation. We'll see how it works.
Colin?
You know, this is actually something I'd like to think about a little bit more. I know how unfair that sounds in the world of journalism. I mean, there's so many different ways to think about franchise, right? One of them is like this. It should be a passive thing. You know, it should be just like air. You know, another way to think about it is it's really a way to do political engineering, so then you have voter ID laws and all that kind of stuff. And then the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? You want people to vote, but in some ways, you do want people to recognize what it is, you know? And so there's a little part of me that's having trouble with this idea. Maybe I'm just too old and set in my ways. There's a little part of me that thinks you should do something affirmative to become a voter, but it might be just me.
Well, it's something worth thinking about, and we'll have plenty of time to talk about that over the next few months. Here's a story we wanted to get to. Republican State Senator Kevin Witkos is calling the Board of Regents a tapeworm. Those are his words. I kind of like it. That's why you don't read that very often. After the Hartford Courant reported that although outgoing Malloy Chief of Staff Mark Ajakian becomes interim president on September 28th, his predecessor Gregory Gray will be paid more than $31,000 a month through the end of this year. Whitco said the Board of Regents is a tapeworm, eating up more and more taxpayer funds
every day. Can you say
every
that word
day.
One more time, John?
I just want to say tapeworm over and over again.
I appreciate that.
Hopefully
Thank
people
you.
Are done eating breakfast. Colin?
Well, they act like a tapeworm who just won Powerball. I mean, you know, they just acted like there's this unlimited amount of money. So there's so many things that are wrong with this, and I don't have time to enumerate them all. Certainly, this idea of paying somebody after they're gone is a long-standing Board of Regents tradition. And the one that was the most obnoxious, I thought, was Michael Gargano, who was the provost under Gray, the guy who just left. Gargano actually probably was on the side of the Angels in the sense that he was sort of on the side of faculty people who were having this Arab Spring about some of Gray's policies. But he quit. And the Board of Regents said, that's it, he's gone. And it was later uncovered, I think, by the Connecticut Mirror, the fact there was this agreement that it was essentially a secret agreement where he'd be paid another $70,000. And there was a non-disparagement clause where he, to get his $70,000, he had agreed not to talk trash about anybody. And I, those are just so undemocratic. I really hate those. But just very quickly, I mean, Marco Jacobs is a great guy. Everybody likes him. I like him. But, I mean, this is symbolic of so many things that are wrong. First of all, you know, he's being moved from a job that he was basically qualified for to a job where his qualifications are questionable. He might be good at it. He might not be good at it. He doesn't really have the right set of qualifications. The state's response to that is to increase his salary by $150,000. So in the job he was suited for, he was worth $187,000. In the job he might not be suited for, he's worth $335,000. Now, who did this? How did this happen? Well, kind of Marco Jakian in a way. Marco Jakian and Tim Bannon and some of Malloy's transition team and early core staff were the ones who created this job. They hired that guy Kennedy for it. You know, he's the guy who had like the chance to go to Michigan or whatever for six to 8 weeks that wasn't his vacation and work there, and he got, you know, free travel to the Van Allen belt and space tourism, and I don't, he got everything. It was like this incredible deal, and he charged all kinds of things to the state. You know, he made over $400,000 in 13 months. He once vouchered us 80 cents for tolls, like he was driving somewhere. I was like, really, dude? So there's been no restraint, no discipline. Tapeworm is a charitable term. Kevin Witkos is absolutely right about this. It's got to be reined in. And then the final part of this, and then I'll stop babbling, it was in Lender's story, which is every single state employee ought to come with a price tag saying, this is what you're really going to cost us if you live a long and fruitful life, which we hope you do. We hope you don't drop dead. But if you live a long and fruitful life, we're not just paying you $335,000 a year. If you get vested for pension at that level, let's talk about what you really cost. Because even if you're only getting $80,000 a year, you could wind up costing us a lot of money if you retire relatively young and live a long life. And we just don't talk about that.
And didn't the argument coming from CSCU saying, well, we were going to be paying him up for six more months, right, past January, but now we're only going to be paying him to December. But I think Colin's point is so well taken. $170,000 in a pension when it's all said and done, where do we sign up for that? And I think that Kevin Witkos is handling this politically in a probably a very good way, because instead of just coming out and saying, Marco Jakian's not qualified for this, I don't like Mark, this is just political posturing, this is just glad-handing and giving out a free gift to one of the Malloy's closest allies, he's saying, well, I don't like how much he's getting paid. I think this is bad. I think he's a tapeworm. So then in 5 or 6 months, let's say something doesn't happen that's bad. So let's say something bad happens with the Board of Regents. He can go, yeah, it was a bad idea from the start, and they're paying him $370,000.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one of the things that Colin has talked about before, and he just mentioned again, Colin, too, is with some of these deals, you end up paying someone all this extra money. You end up paying them in pensions for the rest of their lives. And part of the deal, too, is we never really find out what happens. We never get the inside scoop. And so we're not able to make, as a state, some informed decisions about whether or not we think this Board of Regents thing is, I don't know, a good idea in the first place.
Well, I think we also have a very short attention span. So people can get really riled up about this and really get concerned and, you know, to quote Scalia, consider it jiggery pokery going on there. But at the end of the day, 2 weeks from now, people will be on to something else. And these pensions are set. And I think this is a problem with institution and structure, not just an individual. And addressing that bigger problem, particularly all the issues that people have with having this board structure, with what's happening in colleges and universities across the state, that's a time for us to say, is this right? What's going to be the impact? And if this person doesn't bring those set of skills and we're paying them at this level, What's the consequence going to be for higher education?
Well, but I just wonder, do we start to unwind the system, Colin? That it's only a few years old. You said that the Board of Regents giving away a lot of money is a longstanding tradition. I mean, the whole thing isn't that old an idea. At the end of the day, this is something that over the course of just a Malloy administration and a half, we're probably starting to look at very closely. But is this the best way for us to run this very large system of community colleges and state universities?
The system isn't all that old, but it isn't any different. It isn't substantially different in this regard from the system it replaced. So under the old system, for example, David Carter, who sort of had the old version of this job and was making $400,000 a year. And I think when he tried, he wanted to leave at one point, and they offered him, I think, another $87,000 as a retention bonus. But meanwhile, he decided he didn't like the president of Southern Connecticut State University. So he fired that person and hired another one. So they each were making $280,000. We were paying $560,000 a year to staff that particular position. There's never been any discipline here. And this quote-unquote reform that was enacted by Malloy and his team hasn't really reformed that kind of thing. Meanwhile, when Gray was hired, his first act was to hire a consultant for, I think, was it $1.8 million to re-envision the whole system. So, I mean, you hire a guy for $350 or whatever it is, and the first thing he does is say, well, I actually need $1.8 million worth of help to think about this stuff. I just don't – I'll just say one last thing. Somebody someday, and maybe his name is Kevin Whitehouse, is going to run for governor, probably as a Republican, saying, I really understand how state government works. I really understand, in a way that Tom Foley didn't, where the waste is. And I can fix it without crippling state government, you know, without eviscerating services. I can tell you I can show you the cuts. I've been up here reading budgets for a long time. I know how this works. And that person is going to be able to make a very good case for him or herself.
I want to turn to a last topic for this segment. Discussions are underway on the best way to replace the aging I-84 viaduct running through Hartford. And we've talked already on the program quite a bit about, are we going to build a tunnel through Hartford? Are we going to have a sort of a road that is at grade and people drive over and overpasses? One of the things, though, that we haven't really considered is, how are we going to do all this and how long is it going to take? One idea that got floated, we read about in the Hartford Current this week, is just shutting down a big stretch of the highway, Max, to allow quicker construction. This has happened in other states, and it gets around this whole idea of the massive 10-year nightmare that we'll have around Hartford's own Big Dig, where everyone's waiting in traffic forever. They're just going to shut the thing down, maybe, and just build it from scratch. What do you say?
I have seen this before. I've lived through something like this when I went to college in the Midwest and then worked in the Midwest and made no money. When you drove through downtown St. Louis, they shut down Interstate 40. It disappeared for a period of like 6 years. It just didn't exist anymore. So you had people for 81 days out of the year going to St. Louis Cardinals games, taking little local roads, small local roads, destroying those local roads. And if you talk to the DOT people in that state at the time, they would tell you, oh, this was great. We got it done faster. It wasn't that big of a deal. You talk to people who live there, they go, oh, no, this was terrible. Here's the difference, though. Hartford doesn't have a 50,000-person stadium in downtown where there's a major traffic issue. The difference is you have 100,000 people who have to get to work every day. But I think that this is what – I think that this was the first talking point to try to get into people's heads there's going to be pain. I don't think that this was necessarily the real idea. I think it's just trying to display to people, we want to do transportation. Here's how we want to do it. It's going to hurt. Here's an idea.
It's a nice psychological spin, right? Here's the pain that it could be. So instead, let's go with this option because it will be less painful. John, you sort of know my position on this. I just want to know, can I get from New Haven to Hartford in hour to make it to the show? Or do I have to continue to leave my house at 7 to make it here? That's really what I and a lot of other drivers care about.
And that's what I care about a lot, too. It seems like it's trouble getting from Hamden to Hartford on a regular basis. Colin, I mean, what do we do here?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, on snowy days, for example, these east-west arteries here clog up very quickly. I mean, you really can't move at all, even today, because it's after Labor Day, Asylum Avenue was backing up as I came here in a way that it traditionally doesn't. I'll say this. I mean, it's an interesting question. Do you want to be eaten by a lion or do you want to be nibbled to death by ducks? So this is the eaten by a lion version. It's over really, hopefully, faster if they're as good as their word. But the truth is you have to start transforming culture now. There's a pretty good editorial in The Current about this today, and a 78.7% of commuters commute alone. So you've got to change that. And probably the way you've got to do it is to make them pay for it in one way or another. There's probably too much free parking at companies here. The current editorial, which I'm sure was written by Tom Condon, says that, you know, notes that the state in the worker contract say you can have free parking. What you really want to do is charge for parking and then kick that money back in transit vouchers and other kinds of incentivizing ways. Pay people to ride their bikes to work and stuff like that. Creating a biking culture, because a lot of these commutes are not long. You know, a lot of these commutes that use 84, they're not super long commutes. Combinations of busing, biking, all this kind of stuff could alleviate it. But you've got to change the culture now. You can't change it like when you start construction. It'll be too late. Like tomorrow, you got to start changing the culture.
People know it's going to be painful, but they've also made it very clear they want a better system of roads and bridges.
When we come back from our break, we're going to be talking about God in politics, and it's not all on the conservative side of the ledger. We're talking with Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Kalila Brown, Dean of Quinnipiac University, our own Colin McEnroe. We're in the wheelhouse. It's our weekly news roundtable here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow on the program, mayoral candidate in Hartford, Luke Bronin, will stop by for our Where We Vote series. You'll get a chance to ask questions of the candidate. Hope you can join us. Today, it's in the wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're here with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, and Max Reese from NBC Connecticut. It's been kind of a big week for God in politics. Obviously, you've got the dispute between the jailed county clerk in Kentucky, Kim Davis, who was released from prison yesterday after a short sentence. The judge released her with a caveat she can't get in the way of her deputy clerks issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. It remains to be seen whether she'll comply with that request. She spoke about God to her supporters.
Just keep on pressing. Don't let down. Because he is here. And he's worthy. He's worthy.
One of those standing by her, seemingly grafted onto her, was presidential candidate Mike Huckabee, who supports her right to refuse to do the job the people of Kentucky pay her for. He's spent quite a bit of time saying that the Supreme Court can't make law, essentially suggesting that only God's law matters. Meanwhile, last night we saw the debut of Stephen Colbert's new late-night show on CBS. Among his guests was another candidate, Jeb Bush.
For 7 years, on the Republican side, there's been the emotional needle has been nailed, bang, in one spot, Obama bad, you know, maybe not American, Obama
and
bad.
And vice versa.
And then the Democrats have to argue like he's the best just to counter that emotional narrative that the Republicans have. You think you could change that sort of, the other side is the devil?
Yeah, I do.
And I'd be glad to hear that.
And look, in state capitals all across the country.
I would love it.
In state capitals, this doesn't happen to the same extent it does in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
In the mayor's offices, there are people that disagree with one another, and they're mm-hmm. allowed to talk to one another. Mm-hmm. You can be friends with people that you don't agree with on everything. I mean, we have to restore a degree of civility.
I agree. Because I have to say, I'll restore a degree of civility right now. There is a non-zero chance that I would vote for you. Okay? You seem like a very reasonable guy who believes that governing is something that the government should do.
So Stephen Colbert last night in his debut on CBS talking with Jeb Bush. Colbert fits into this narrative by being an obvious liberal in a job that is often apolitical, while also being a different kind of liberal, a practicing Catholic who has been known to say things like this.
Because if this is going to be a Christian nation that doesn't help the poor, either we've got to pretend that Jesus was just as selfish as we are, or we've got to acknowledge that he commanded us to love the poor and serve the needy without condition, and then admit that we just don't want to do it.
Okay, so that's Stephen Colbert. All of this is happening against the backdrop of Pope Francis's upcoming trip to the States, in which U.S. politicians are lining up to get tickets. Here's the premise of my question for you all, and Colin, you've written about this on your blog. It seems as though God might be back in politics, and not necessarily just on the Mike Huckabee conservative side of things. Do you see some of this?
Yeah, I mean, Hugh Blumenfeld, who was in here as a sort of singer-songwriter, he once did a song called That Long-Haired Radical Socialist Jew, and it was about Jesus. And really, you know, I mean, certainly one way to read Jesus is much closer to what Colbert, and really Pope Francis could have said almost exactly the thing that Colbert said. I mean, they really are sort of very, very close on that. And this is very close to my heart, too. As you know, I've been attending church probably more regularly than I have in my life lately, and it's what we think and talk about a lot there. You know, what really does the Bible say? What does Jesus say? What really is the content of all this? And it does seem to be so much more about economic justice and inclusion and so much not about exclusion. And the last thing I'll say is that this isn't an entirely new idea. In 1992, there was a movement within the Democratic Party called the politics of meaning. And the notion was that liberals and Democrats could reclaim the spiritual or religious narrative. Interestingly, the two architects of it were Michael Lerner, who's the editor of Tikkun, and Hillary Clinton, who was then the wife of the candidate for president. So, you know, it's a new idea, and then it's an old idea.
It's a new idea. It's an old idea. It feels fresh or different somehow in 2015, Max. I don't know.
Well, Governor Kasich in Ohio, during his run for president, whenever he's asked about why did he expand Medicaid, he said when he gets to heaven, if he's asked the question, what do you do for the poor, he said, I expanded Medicaid. You know, he brought God into the race in that way. And then you have John Boehner from the same state, a Catholic, when asked about climate change, the things that Pope Francis has said about climate change, he says, oh, I think he needs to stay out of the conversation on that. You know, what is the line between politics and God at this stage in the game? And, you know, just like you said, you know, we're going to see tens of thousands of people when he gets here next week or the week after. Week after, right?
It's the week after, yeah.
And, you know, it is a fascinating juxtaposition between God and the political framework as we see it in America.
Yeah, and politicians lining up either standing close to the Pope or maybe standing a little bit away, Kalilah, from this new Pope who's bringing some different ideas.
Well, I think it's also the question of whose God do we like, right? Like, let me keep my God, you give up your God, and then we can talk about
my
politics.
My God has a leather jacket and looks like the Fonz.
I mean, hey. but, you know, as someone who grew up, I grew up in Lynchburg, Virginia, where Jerry Falwell, Liberty University, Moral Majority were based. And we saw what happened when you blur the line between religion and politics. Halloween fell on a Sunday when I was a kid. Falwell had that observation moved. And the justification was, well, kids have to go to school on Monday. And I remember thinking, oh, so if we trick-or-treat on Monday, does that mean school's canceled on Tuesday as well, right? No, it didn't work that way. So people are concerned. If your spirituality is going to guide you and be how you make these decisions, that's fine. But what's the line? Does that mean your spirituality prevents you from doing your job because you believe that's a violation of your beliefs? Or does it make you more aware of a calling to really address how people are suffering? That's the type of spirituality I would like to see in politics. If it becomes, I want to become a martyr so that I can promote a particular belief system, I don't think that's where we need to be.
You know, one of the critiques of President Obama that's always been ridiculous is that he's either a socialist or a Marxist. All right, well, he's like a Marxist the way I'm Lou Alcindor. I mean, it's insane. I mean, it's just a crazy thing to say about him. He's very much a creature of capitalism. He's a guy who really believes, you know, in Wall Street and capitalism. You're about to meet a Marxist. You know, the guy who's coming is, I think, by most definitions, Marxist in his orientation and Marxist in his critique of capitalism. He's also the Pope, and that's going to be an interesting thing. There are going to be people who have some real cognitive dissonance with that one. It's going to be very difficult to reconcile this guy's critique, which is very much the economic justice critique that sort of international Catholicism has directed at concentrations of wealth for years. But coming out of this Pope's mouth, the way he says it, it's going to freak people out.
Well, maybe it'll freak people out, and we just have a minute left, Colin, but I mean, does it actually change anything? And we talk about politics a lot here on the program. Does it change anything about the way in which politicians have to actually orient themselves around this conversation? I mean, do they just sort of wait for him to go away and then do whatever they were going to do before? Or do they have to grapple with this notion that he's bringing with them?
I'm sure they'll do the former, but it does change other things. The change happens in a much more gradual and sort of one leaf at a time way. And so the words of Francis will touch various people. Those people will do things in a different way that they haven't than they might have done them in the past. Not everybody, but some people. That's how truth spreads. That's how faith spreads. And probably that's how Francis's message will spread.
This Pope's popularity is unbelievable, and the way it clashes with the American political class is going to be fascinating in 2 weeks.
But I think it's even more important and more effective that it is touching people and not necessarily politicians. To think of where we were in 1960 when JFK had to give a speech on religion to let the American people know I'm guided by my faith, but I'm not beholden to it. It also shows the progress that can be made when everyday people have those conversations.
I'm a Catholic and it's okay.
Dr. Kalilah Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. Thank you so much, Kalilah, as
always.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks to Max Rees, NBC Connecticut's political reporter. Thank you, Max.
Great to be here.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you so much, Colin.
Thanks, Mr. Dankosky.
Our program is always produced by Tucker Ives, with help from Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalea. Our technical producer is Tyone Wolf, running the board in there. WNPR's digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for listening to Where We Live.